Hi, I'm Emil Heskey, and join me on the Hero's Journey.
Guys, welcome back to the Hero's Journey with Emil Heskey. And again, we're continuing with Mark Wilson. So, hi guys.
Good morning.
Hey, good morning.
So we kind of finished off the last talk. We were talking a lot about agents and football agents in general. And Mark was kind of just describing a lot of the roles of the agents, authenticity of agents, and being passionate about what you're doing, being in service. So we want to kind of continue that on and let Mark kind of just continue his trail of thought, and obviously Emil as well, coming from the other side as a player. So we're just going to listen to these guys discussing the role of the football agent and where it lies in football, and are they justified, and the challenges of being an agent in football. So Mark, if you just want to continue just talking about what you kind of feel is the role, because we were talking about the transition of how football agents kind of came in. You started talking a little bit about it. If you can just go into a little bit more about them being seen as Emil said in the last talk, as a necessary evil to some people. If you can just talk more about that and where you see football agents can improve, as well as the challenges of becoming a football agent.
Yeah, well, like I touched on before, the original role of, as I see it, my understanding of the agent was to represent the client's best interests commercially regarding their deal with the, negotiating their deal with the football club. That's kind of been expanded now and kind of changed. And now the agent's role is, you know, is manifold. Mm-hmm. But it also includes having connections to transfer your player to another club, which wasn't, I may be wrong, but I don't think that was the original kind of intention. So I guess why agents have kind of been vilified a little bit in the press and the football world is because fans see that people are taking, agents are taking their players away from the club that they love. So I think that's where it's kind of evolved, if you like. Being an agent, I mean, Emil obviously had a few clubs in his career, so it would be interesting to see his point of view. Whether also people wanted to, like fans, he got backlash from fans when he moved clubs, and you know, did his agent get the brunt of that?
I didn't get backlash, to be honest with you. When I left Leicester to go to Liverpool, I actually could have left when I was 18. I stayed till 22. So I'd done, and we'd been to three cup finals in 4 years. Won two of them. So in a sense, it looked, I was saying to myself, I'd done enough. I need to take that next step. Yes, they weren't happy that I was moving on, but they never held a grudge in that sense. To go back to what you're saying, I know the head of the agency that I was with, I think he had a conversation with the then manager and said, they're going to get me to sign a new deal. And not long later, I left. So I don't think that was a bitter pill to swallow, but nothing was said to me at the time that I was going to be signing a new deal.
Oh. Well, that's really interesting, actually, because that kind of touches upon the kind of integrity of agents and the kind of different type of agents that they are, and you know, there are. Sorry, I'm including myself. I'm one of them. I'm in the industry, so it's very difficult to be totally honest and keep everybody honest when you're an agent, because you're speaking to so many different parts. So if every agent was totally honest and said, listen, my client's going to sign a new contract, like it sounds like happened in the past with Emil, the clubs will be happy, and then they would expect you to sign. But then if someone else comes in and says, listen, we want to buy you, they're not, obviously you've broken your word. So I think that's why agents are sometimes kind of, you know, try to be honest, but ambiguous at the same time, because it's such a fluid market now. It's moving constantly. But likewise, clubs do the same thing. You know, clubs, I've had, you know, the transfer window is literally just finished. And I've had clubs saying that they want my client to stay. Then the next minute, he's available to go. And then the next minute, they wanted to stay again. So it works both ways for everyone. So I think it's quite difficult to maintain your word. I think that's why people don't really want to give their word, because it could change at any time.
Yeah. That example you're giving there, I had that as well. Another club came in. I asked where I stood. They said, no, we need you, blah, blah, blah. I never played again. And then never got a contract.
See? That just goes, that's an example of, you know, why people have agents. Because, you know, ultimately, what separates a good agent, in my opinion, from the rest is somebody who has the experience to weigh up a situation and say, listen, you know, even though the manager's saying this, I think we need to go because I don't think you're going to play. I'm not saying you didn't have a good agent at the time, Emil, but it's just, you know, it's guesswork, it's experience, it's making those crucial decisions for your client. I'm guessing that happened at the end of, towards the end of your career.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's more difficult for an agent if it happens to a client at the beginning of their career when they're younger, because if you get that wrong, the client, the player might hold you responsible for that.
Yeah.
So there's big margin calls there.
I was just going to interject here for a sec. There's a few things that you said that I found interesting from the perspective of a football agent. Like, a lot of people may not know some of the things you guys are discussing about how it may be perceived that the football agent is making decisions for the player in their best interests by changing club to club or giving very short notice, or apparently seeming that a footballer thinks that they're playing for another season, all of a sudden they're leaving out the door in a week. But from what you're saying, you guys are both saying, it's like sometimes you have to just roll the dice because things are happening so quickly and so fluidly. You have to try to transition the person in the best way possible based on so many fluid circumstances.
Yeah.
That's so accurate. I mean, you know, like I said, if you've got a player as an agent in a certain position playing maybe as a, I don't know, a winger, and then the club all of a sudden on the last day brings in two wingers, and all of a sudden you're thinking, well, my player's not going to play. I need him to play, and the player wants to play. It might be the best option to go and get some games, but that could happen so quickly, and sometimes there's not enough time to do anything about it. But yeah, you're constantly evaluating the situation because it's constantly changing. And because most people, like I said, in football can't be upfront with you. Maybe I'll change my statement and I won't say that they're not honest, because I don't feel they can be honest. Because, for example, let's say a manager says he's only honest at the time of his comments. So he might say, listen, I want you to stay. You're going to stay. You're going to get games. And then all of a sudden, his chief exec comes to him and says, hang on a minute, we've been told we can get this player, which is a better player than your client. All of a sudden, that player comes into the building. They're going to start the match. And then the manager's kind of left with his word, where he said to the client, I want you to stay and play. So it is so fluid and it does change. And, you know, I don't, to be honest as well, like I said before, the agent thing, it was easy. I think it's kind of changing now. I think it's changing now that anybody can become an agent. Like I said, anyone can go online to the FA as long as they haven't got certain criminal paths. Like, you know, they can pass the certain tests online and declarations. So anybody can do it now. So I think, from my feeling, people are less anti-agents now, because it really is, you know, pay your money, sign up and become an agent yourself now. So I think it's, and because we've been around so long, I think it's the kind of perception is changing, because I think more people will know more agents now, because anybody can sign up. Well, listen, anyone can sign up and get a license essentially, but obviously doing the job is a different thing. Mm. But yeah, I am, you know, if I was looking and saying, am I over the, 18 years, been working in the industry, have I seen a change in people's attitudes, clubs' attitudes to agents? I think, yeah, because I think people are more informed now anyway, with the kind of coverage, social media coverage, you know, the news coverage and stuff like that. So, I think it's kind of changing a little bit, and people are understanding what the role is. And what's really funny is I told you obviously how I became an agent and my motivations for getting into the business were, I didn't know what a football agent was. I just actually became a football agent. I was doing the role of helping people and taking them to trials without any expectation to be reimbursed. And then realized, okay, this is a business, you can get paid for it. But the irony is now I see young people growing up wanting to become football agents. So it's actually become a career in that time, which is, I find encouraging actually.
Well, you see a lot of, especially now the younger generation, their older brothers are going to college and doing a business course, doing accountancy, and then they're becoming the younger brother's agent.
Yes. Yeah. Which is, in my opinion, as long as you're qualified, I think it's not a bad thing. It can be a bad thing in the sense of sometimes you can be, in my opinion, I think sometimes you can be too close to the player. So you won't make decisions as an agent. You'll make decisions as a family member. And sometimes I think that can cloud judgment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the other thing that you had mentioned in just one of the earlier statements, just about this whole, with regards to the challenges of kind of being a football agent, we're talking about the perception of how other people see it. But just, and you've kind of touched on it a little bit here, but just what do you think, you kind of mentioned it a little bit, but more broadly, the kind of the criteria that you feel that should be there for a football agent? Obviously, experience is key, but if somebody's just starting in the field of football agency, no matter how much they've studied, experience comes through time. So what, other than that, what qualities do you think are key initially for somebody to be a football agent? As in, are we talking about, obviously, authenticity supersedes everything in all fields of sport, all fields of life, etiquette and these sort of things, passion. What do you think is missing with a lot of, because obviously me and you've spoken before about, there are certain agents out there that are quite in it for the wrong reason, in that they're just in it for the money, and sometimes they're making decisions more for themselves rather than for their players. In some respects, they will get their players the best deal so long as it serves them, but I know with you sometimes it's been almost opposite, that way you're so focused on doing a service for the player that sometimes you have, you know, not gotten the best deals because of it. What's the middle ground between that, and what do you think makes someone, what should be, how should a good agent really operate?
Okay, so from my perspective, a good agent should operate for the client, but be able to give the client the best advice and guidance towards which, for their kind of whole career, the footballing career, where they should go, which clubs they should move to, like we talked about earlier. But just going back and touching on what you said about people doing it for self-gain, the industry, maybe it hasn't changed. Maybe it was always like that. But the point I'm making is, it's a business now. So the skills that people will need to get into the industry now, it's no longer about the football knowledge. That's helpful to an extent, but it's almost gone full circles where you have to be a business savvy, you have to have business acumen, you have to be able to assess situations, not the footballing side of it, because the footballing side of it is there to an extent, but the clubs have all the tools now with, you know, the systems, Instat, Wise Scout, Statistics, Opta, and, you know, others that they use. They kind of look at the data and say, right, we identify the player. So the fundamental role hasn't changed. It's about being a strong negotiator, knowing your client's worth, and getting them the best value. Now, where this falls down, in my opinion, sometimes is that some people, it's a chicken and egg situation, so which has been created because you can only sign a player for 2 years. So if you can only sign a player for 2 years and you're running a business, you owe it to your business to try and make the most out of that client as an agent for those 2 years you've got the client. Because if the client leaves you after those 2 years is up, then you can't guarantee you're going to get the next commission. And that's the chicken and egg situation. So, for example, if you take a player at, I don't know, 17, and you've got a chance to move them to a bigger club where you think, actually, they're not going to play, and you think their career will disappear down the pan. They won't, you know, they'll go to a really big club, they'll end up in the reserves, and then within two or three seasons, they'll be back in the lower leagues of football because that's the way it goes. But as an agent, you have a dilemma. You have a moral dilemma. If you have a chance to take a certain commission that works for your company, then you have to look at that. I'm being realistic. I'd be lying if I said I wouldn't assess that situation. And if I thought that the player should stay and play, that's what we talked about in the past. I've looked and made decisions where I've said, okay, it's better for the player to come here. The player will, you know, progress. He'll play games and the value will grow. And then players after that have left. So loyalty, that's the problem. If there's no loyalty from the players, and it's very difficult because a 17-year-old player, it's like the only way to liken it is to a relationship. So if you are a young person at 17, 18, and you've met, they say you've got one agent, however you were introduced, normally it will be through a family member at that age. You know, they would say, okay, well, I know this agent or whatever, however you got introduced. So you've met this agent, you've built a relationship with them for 2 years. Then you get to 20 and then you start thinking, actually, is the grass greener? You know, what's on the other side? Yeah. And that's what happens to a lot of agents. So you could spend all that first 2 years from 18 to 20 and make almost no money or a very small contract as an agent. And then someone comes in at 20, 21 and the player thinks, actually, for no reason, you could have done a good job, you could have done everything correctly, just other than curiosity. And they decide that they want a change. And then another agent comes in and they will, unfortunately or fortunately, if you're that agent, get the larger commission, which you've put all the work and time into. So, yeah, that was kind of a big learning curve for me in the past. But it's led me to where I am today, and it's changed my personal, the way I work. And it's about choosing good characters, assessing the characters of the people I want to work with, and only working with the people I want to work with, which is good. I'm in a position that I'm able to do that.
Yeah, there's not many agents in that position, though, is there, Mark?
No, I was going to say that there's not. That, you know, I've got to a point where I can choose who I want to work with, but obviously, you know, I'm not a young man anymore. But if you're a young agent starting off, of course, you'll have to go through that kind of learning curve. But I would say that it's the industry that's caused this. Like, because you can only, I do agree with that, you should only be able to sign someone for 2 years, because it keeps people honest and it takes away kind of, you know, that kind of, for want of another word, the kind of slave mentality where if you've got someone in contract and they can't move and you're really not getting along, you should be able to release yourself and be able to say, listen, let's part ways. So I do understand that, and I do get it, but it's hopefully I've explained a little bit about why the industry is like it is and why agents, certain agents, which I can understand, think I need to just make as much money as I can because I've been burnt before. I've done everything I can for these players and they still leave me. So you have to strike the balance. You have to be able to say, listen, it's great, you know, having this player, but at the end of the day, you have to still remember that you have a responsibility to your own business.
To your own business. Yeah. So just for a second, I want to ask Emil a question just from the other perspective, because obviously what we're talking about is really based around football right now, but I want to open this up into more of a human problem as well. So I want to kind of just branch into that for a moment as well. But before I get to that...
Before you ask Emil the question, I'd just like to quickly add to that.
Yeah.
In my time, the most successful players have only ever had maybe one change of agent. They're normally loyal to their agent. And what happens then is that the agent is loyal back to the player and will do anything for them. And they're normally the most successful players. They've always stuck with one agent, maximum two. Sorry, please continue. I just wanted to get...
That's good that I did that. So like I said, I want to bring this into a broader problem. Because again, when we're dealing with money, and again, I'm going to bring Emil in and just ask a more football related question and then come back to what I'm kind of going to discuss openly, which is more of a human problem, which is obviously when we're looking at greed and human nature. And one of the things that we know with human nature in general is that most humans, their focus is always me first. It's always an I-ism. It's more all about what's the best thing I can do in any relationship at any given time. So like you gave the example of the young child, even if you're doing a good job, they normally want to find something new because that's the curiosity of the mind. The mind always wants something new. But before we kind of just go down that broad role, just going back for a moment for Emil, because obviously you've been in the role of the footballer having agents. Just kind of, I know Mark spoke for a little while on this, but your perspective of the role of a football agent in your life, did you feel the need to stick with one agent for a certain amount of time? Did you kind of understand that there were so many other agents throwing deals at you and it was just for them to get, was it for you from your perspective, they were just wanting money from me or...
If I'm honest, I never thought about agents at all until, obviously I had an agent which I had throughout my career, like Mark just said. I think I had him from the age of 17 or 18 and stayed with him until 36, 37. So the relationship was obviously a friendship relationship. He took care of everything there and I just played football. I never thought about it any differently than that. It's only when you get a little bit older, that's when you start to really think. And I never really thought about leaving him or anything like that because the relationship was fine. He got me the clubs that I needed to when I needed a club and that was it.
Cool. Okay, then do you understand the role like for the young people growing up? Because Mark, I suppose in some respects, and Emil, it's kind of like a lot of these younger players, they need mentors. We've spoken about a little bit before, but also the agent can sometimes act as a really good mediator to help kind of, you know, cover the bases between the football club, a possible other football club, the family members, what's right for the player, and what makes the most amount of money, what makes the best business sense.
I do think, and going back onto what Mark said, I do think you do, especially like you just said, a mediator. I do think you need someone outside of the family to be that mediator. You don't need someone inside the family because they can look at it differently. And as well, you've got a lot of impressionable kids at football clubs. Now, if one agent's getting another kid football boots, £200 football boots, and you're not getting it, it can look strange, and that's where your head can be turned a lot. And it's the simplest of things, you know, football boots, track suits, this, that, and you're like, well, why aren't my agent getting this? But you've got to understand that you're probably not in the same bracket as that player, and the player's just got to understand himself, and it's hard to tell a young kid, well, I play alongside that guy, I should get the same. Not necessarily. you're not on the same contract, so why do you think you're going to get the same?
Yeah, that's interesting.
But it is because I've played with players. And even when I was younger, I played with, when I was at Leicester as a young kid, I knew, and I questioned it at times in myself, why is he getting paid more than me? But I was playing every week at 18, but I was, I that was where I was at the time. Within the system. So, you know, agents as well, they the players need to actually need to be told and need to be taught and need to be mentored as well.
Totally agree with that. I think one thing that really hasn't changed, and I remember someone saying this when I was 17, 18, they said the money will follow you. Said, just play on the pitch. If you do anything on the pitch, the money will follow you. And that's still true today. You know,
yeah,
100%. You know, like you said, at the end of the day, people, greed, and it goes back to the type of character that the player is. If the player just wants to play and they play well, hopefully they can understand. And, you know, that's the job of the agent to explain to them. If you just concentrate on the football, the money will follow you by default. But, you know, you're not going to earn what this person's earning. This person's earned this because they've done that. It might have even been they've just played 5 Premier League matches and then they've stopped, but they've already on that contract.
Yeah.
But if you play and you play well, then the money will follow you. People will offer you contracts from different clubs, from your same club. So that, for me, that hasn't changed in all this time. It's still the same. If you play well, the money will follow you. People will offer you contracts by default. People will offer you sponsorship deals. You know, you don't have to go seeking for it, but you have to find the right character of young person who actually believes that. And that's what Emil says. That's the tricky point, because not everybody has that, because of what you said, Warren, regarding the human brain being kind of conditioned to be greedy and think about themselves first and think about money. It's not always that easy, but yeah, it is. Would I say it's a problem? I'd say it's a problem with the people who aren't educated, but if you are educated and it's really interesting, actually, it's a really good point. And I'm going to give, without obviously mentioning the people, I'm going to give examples. So,
yeah.
Obviously, I worked in France a lot, and I don't know if I've mentioned this before, but basically there was a young lad who his dad asked me to come over and help him with a contract, which I did, to do his first contract. And we were driving to the club, and I remember saying to the dad, look, this is the strategy I'm going to use, this is what I'm going to do, this is what I'm going to say, just to clarify the thoughts and you know, just having a discussion about the negotiation and what we should expect. And then the young 17-year-old got involved and said, oh, look, you know, they're not going to offer this, I want this, I want this, I want this. And it made me realise, actually, and he never changed his character. I looked after him for a long time, I think it was about 7 years, and he never changed his character. It was always about the money from 17 years old. You know, he wasn't in the first team yet. It was on the cusp of the first team. But it was always about money. And his career went down the pan as I knew it would. And did silly things like wouldn't take advice, you know, was renting an apartment instead of buying one when he had the money to, renting a big flash Mercedes convertible when he, you know, he didn't need to and didn't have that type of money to do it. And then, you know, the club used to call me up and say, listen, this player hasn't paid their tax bill.
Wow.
So we're going to, because in France, it's slightly different. It's not like where your PAYE, they give you all the money.
And then you've got to pay it.
Yeah. Which is, you know, a lot of responsibility. But it was just an example. And I remember there was another player that one of, you know, when I worked for a previous company, and I was speaking to an agent. He had a player exactly the same age and exactly the same salary. And his player at 22 had bought 2 flats and lived like a, you know, didn't live beyond his means, lived not a meager lifestyle, but you know what I mean. He did not a flash lifestyle, renting stuff and buying stuff that they shouldn't have been really doing on that contract. And it was a stark moment of realization for me to see the difference of two people the same age with two totally different mentalities, and now one of them's playing for a top club in Europe, you know, like I'm talking top Champions League club. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously the one who had the kind of the mindset to carry on working hard, not I've kind of made it because I've just, you know, got a little contract and, you know, not trying to demonstrate to the world I can live in a big flat and I can drive a nice car. It was all the kind of material stuff, which does take away from the football. I don't care what anyone says when it doesn't. It does. And the clubs don't like it either. The clubs, you know, old school
managers,
football.
Managers, clubs.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, you turn up. I remember someone telling me that, you know, they were in a relegation battle. A Premier League club, sporting director I spoke to, he said, we're in a relegation battle. He said, and it's just not helpful when this guy, who like, turns up in a like 200 grand McLaren, whatever it is, to work. It's like, it's just, it's not helpful. It doesn't help the mindset. Yeah. And I don't even think that guy was in the team, but... Sorry, I don't know if I've gone off tangent.
No, it's good. It's good. There's a few things you said. Yeah.
But again, does that boil down to mentors and different backgrounds? Because I'm guessing the guy, the player that was a bit more prudent with his money and
I know where Emil's going with this. This was going to be my question. Go on.
Go on. Sorry, with his money is come from a more stable background where. His family have guided him down the right path.
I was going to be a bit more direct than that.
go on. You say what you want to say.
You know what we're all thinking. While you were talking, Mark, I was just, because I had a few questions written down and Emil's being very, very politically correct.
Yes, he was black.
Yes, that's exactly where we were all going with it. And people listen to this, Mike.
And the other boy was white.
Yeah.
That's the reality.
And the thing is people listen to this, and I know Emil's being politically correct when he was asked the questions, but we all know this, and it's a reality. The fact that we're all sitting here thinking this, and people listening are kind of thinking that guy's probably white and that guy's probably black, shows you, as a matter of fact, that this is typically one of the most... Obviously, Emil's black, and he didn't fall into that role, so it's not cut across the whole thing, but it is a typical scenario that when we see that, it's typical that a lot of the young black players are doing that. And this kind of is a question for both of you now. And this is where I kind of wanted to just come off the football and get directly into life for a second with regards to this question. But it is relating to football, but it's also relating to life. Do you both feel that the injection of... Because obviously there's far more money in football now than it was 20 years ago with all the football coverage and adverts and sponsorship and all that sort of stuff. Do you both feel that people are getting into, as in some people, are getting into football now? They may like it, but it's not their passion, but they're getting into it or being pushed into it because they're talented. Their parents may see that they're talented. And they're getting into it because of the money in the game now rather than pure passion.
Do you want to go first, Mark?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I would say no. I would say it's always been like that. I don't think it's the amount of money. So different continents, different people. If you're from, you know, parts of Africa, for example, Cameroon, Nigeria, some people can see it now as a chance to make money. But they did then. They did 20 years ago and thought it's a chance. You know, someone goes, becomes a footballer in Europe and sends money back home. That still happens. So I don't think that's changed from that perspective. From an English perspective or a French perspective, no, I don't think so. I think it's become entwined with this celebrity lifestyles. Of course, footballers are celebrities more now because of social media and, you know, the access that people have. But I think the only one that's been publicly come out and said that, you know, they don't really like football was the boy at Tottenham, the Cameroonian left back who said, like, listen, I don't love football, but it's my job and I'm good at it. No, and that's fine. You know, I've actually worked with players before who have said the same thing. So I think it's probably, I'd still say it's probably a minority, but I would also say it was probably a class background, and it depends if people have got other things to do. So if you've got someone who, sorry, maybe not a class background, but just people who have other things, other business interests.
Like, or they have a medical background, they've got a doctor or something like that, something else that they can fall back on.
Absolutely. So, whereas if it's their only thing that they can do and it's their only sole means of earning potential, then, I think they're still kind of, you know, it's not really all about money. I think, in my opinion, I think it hasn't changed that much. But, Emil, sorry.
I would go different to you. I would probably say, a lot of it is a lot about money. I came in when there wasn't, I didn't even think it was a career or anything like when I first came in, to be honest with you. But then obviously the money started to jump, and don't get me wrong, there were celebrities back in the day. They were driving big cars back in the day, but social media and media never really portrayed it like that. But with the portrayal of flash cars and big houses and all that in the media and now social media era, everyone wants to be going down that line. And even now you're looking at YouTubers earning vast amount of money through the stuff they put on YouTube and getting sponsors. Now they're living in massive houses, driving unbelievable cars, going on private jets. And now everyone wants to be a YouTuber. That is what everyone looks at, the lifestyle and the money before the actual career that they're actually wanting to go into.
So, I mean, and I'm glad you both had opposing views in some respects. Because, like I said, it's for me, it's more of a bigger picture, obviously a bigger problem than obviously just football, but we all know that. But I know our theme here is mainly based on football. And I definitely feel for myself that football, like just your example, Mark, earlier about the guy who was so obsessed with the best contract rather than playing the long game and just realizing if you're good enough, money will come. An example of that we all know is someone like Floyd Mayweather, who initially, when he was earlier in his career, he was paid what he thought was slave contracts. And he publicly said that, even though it was millions of dollars and a lot of people thought, no, I'm going to just take the money. And he just kept on winning and winning and winning. And not a lot of people truly liked him in the industry, but he's kept on winning and winning and winning to the point where he could start to call his own income. And now we know he's the... He's made the greatest amount of money of any boxer ever. He's made over $1 billion. No boxers come even near that. And, you know, he's made $1.3 billion just from boxing. And the closest person to him was, I think, Tyson, who made about $450 million. And he, as you said, was more focused on his talent, and his talent will bring about the wealth. Obviously, he made a vast amount of that wealth in the last 5-6 years of his career when he was like 35. So he'd waited quite a long time, but he truly invested the time in his skill set to create the income that he wanted. Whereas, Mark, you were saying earlier, there are certain people in it, and we were kind of alluding to certain young black people that are so fixated on just income and bling, and as soon as they're making money, spending it straight away and not thinking about the long game. And invariably, their focus shifts to how much money can I make in how little time versus I actually love just doing this and I enjoy the idea of doing it and then money will come at some point. What are your thoughts on that?
It's funny that you should say that. The first couple of years, first year or so in the Premier League, so I was in what is now the Championship, and I played a full season in that. We won promotion through the playoffs, beating Stoke, and then went into the Premier League. And I would have been on at the time, and I'm a regular player. I think I would have been on no more than £500 a week.
Mm. Wow.
Yeah. My first contract was £350, and then I think after that it was £500. My appearance was £800.
Mm. So you really did play the long game.
I never thought about it until later on in your career. You're thinking, why was I on so little when I was playing regular. I was every week. So
yeah.
I never thought of it. I just thought playing football. I just wanted to play football. Mm. I never thought. But then
you know what? It's a good job. It's a good job you did, because you obviously, you know, you got your rewards and your bigger contracts later. And it, maybe if you had thought about the money, you wouldn't have, because your focus would have shifted. You might have had a little bit of resentment. And then for me, it all goes downhill from there. When the player has resentment at the club or in any walk of life, when anybody feels in any job that they're being undervalued or underpaid, they never do a job to the full maximum, their full maximum potential. It doesn't happen.
Your thought process is not towards what you're supposed to be doing, which is performing on the pitch. It's on. It's elsewhere.
Mm. Yeah. So, and for yourself, Mark, I mean, you kind of just mentioned or alluded to it a little bit. Do you feel like that's one of the qualities that's missing in a lot of these youngsters that are initially getting in the game, is their focus is on, okay, what's the best contract, the most money I can make right now, versus is it more about just playing the game and creating a body of work that can't be denied, and then you'll make those contracts later? Do you normally have to have those conversations with these young people, and do a lot of them tend to ignore it?
No, I think it goes back to what we were talking about. Everything comes back to somebody's upbringing and somebody's moral compass and somebody's education. So there will be young people, and sometimes it's always influenced by a family member. So, you know, you'll get young people who just want to play and don't care about the money, like Emil did, and wouldn't focus on the money. I wouldn't say they don't care, but they wouldn't focus on it. Mm. And they let other people take care of that, knowing that if they do well, the money will come, and they believe that they will get rewarded, you know, their value. But then you do have some people in this instance that I gave you the example of, where, you know, when I look back, the father was kind of like that. You know, as soon as the boy earned a bigger contract, the father stopped working. And it wasn't a massive contract, but the father stopped working, and, you know, he's like, and started taking some money off the son. When, you know, this is an enabled man who's able to work.
Yeah.
It's a different mentality. It's a different mindset. It's a, you know, that's where it's kind of at, really.
Can I just ask on that, kind of what me and Emil were kind of saying to you earlier, in your experience, was the people, the fathers or family members that stopped working, were they black? Or it was just different people as opposed to different cultural backgrounds?
No, I think it does, they were black. And I think it was a black father, black son. And I think, it's about, like I said, it could be white as well.
But did you experience that?
I haven't experienced it
okay.
yet. No.
Okay.
But that takes me on to another subject, which is for another podcast, which is looking at representation of different ethnicities from different agents. But that's probably going to have to be in part three.
Yeah, I'm just going to make a note of that. Emil, did you want to chime in on what we just spoke about with the different racial backgrounds?
Yeah, I think again, it goes down to the cultural backgrounds as well, and as well schooling. I think schools could do a lot more to help people from a less disenfranchised background, to enable them to understand when it comes to financial stuff. Because it's funny that you should say that. My parents did the same.
Okay.
They did exactly the same. They stopped working. I took on the... I bought our family house.
Okay.
And took on the bills and took on everything.
And that was... Emil, that was when you were 18 or 19, right?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, but again, I don't blame them, because if I was from that same... 90 to probably 100% of the people from the background that we came from and the area that we came from would have done the same.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Because of the system that we're in and how we understood the system.
Of course. But saying that, would you do that to your children, knowing what you got now? Okay.
And I advise my friend's kids, and I advise my friend whose son plays football, never to do that. Never to burden that child with anything to do with you.
Mm. Yes. Yes.
You're not like you're unable to do stuff yourself. You're able, so do it yourself.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. It's great that you went through that experience to be able to.
Yeah, because firsthand I can tell people. Would I change it? No, I've come out of it fine. So it's not a major problem for me. But I look back and say, what if I'd broken my leg?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So digressing slightly, just because we've only got about 20 minutes left at the most, we haven't even touched on your career, your highs and lows, Mark. Let's kind of go back onto that for a bit.
Okay.
We'll kind of just finish this off with just you talking about some of your... So again, relating it back to the hero's journey and going through a lot of these, you know, we've spoken a lot about the call to action, the meeting of mentors and teachers and guides that kind of brought you into the football field, and then the crossing the threshold, which is the stage where you kind of live your sport or your activity or identity. We haven't really gotten into a lot of the tests, challenges that have come about as you being a football agent. So I'd like to just kind of talk about, again, we were alluding to this at part one, the highs and lows, some of the highs and lows in your life. And because we don't want this to be all doom and gloom and stuff. We just want it to be a thing where, just give us an example of some of the challenges and ordeals that you've gone through as being an agent. Also, if there were challenges being a black agent. And then what kind of lessons have you learned from that you can pass on as life lessons?
Well, the way in for me was obviously taking people for trials, and one person who helped a lot actually was a player called Brian Steen.
Yeah.
And he was a assistant coach at Luton, and you know, he arranged some matches for me. I think there was Marvin Johnson as well was there. So they had a couple of black staff, and they kind of opened the door. So what one thing that obviously I would always do and I do is try and open the door for, you know, for younger black agents coming up, because, you know, it's kind of continued.
Yeah.
I'm just continuing the work that I was doing, you know, Ricky Hill, these type of guys. They were the guys kind of... Sorry.
No, sorry, I was just saying pay it forward.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, paying it forward. Sorry. Regarding that, that was kind of the entry into getting people trials and so forth. Regarding trials, tribulations, you know, trying to look at what I did in the beginning. Obviously, it was a lot different because I didn't have the experience, and maybe. It's difficult to tell whether I was treated a certain way because I was a new agent, or whether I was black, or a combination of the two. Probably a combination of the two. But what I would say about this whole industry in general is that it's like any other industry. It's the network that you're in, and black people in general aren't in the what people would call an old boys network. We don't have many black managers. We don't have many black sporting directors in positions of authority. So by default, if you're an agent who's going out for drinks with the chief executive of a football club, or you're more friendly, or you've got more in common, you're more likely to do business by osmosis. I'm not even saying there's any conscious bias in the industry. I'm saying it's just how the world works. It's how life works, in my opinion. I don't think people think, oh, that person's black, you know, I'm not going to deal with him. I don't think that happens so much. I just think it's a kind of unconscious bias that this guy's my mate. And then that's changing to certain parts. If you can be friendly with some people, you can get into a network, and then people will treat you the same. But if you're not in that network, then it's quite difficult to break into the small community.
Mm. I just want to add something on that before we continue, actually. I watched a program some years ago. It was talking about billionaires and millionaires in the UK. And this lady had compiled a report on the industry and why it was predominantly white people or people of white skin that were highly successful. And she was saying a lot of it is pretty much what you were saying. It was more biases, and because she was saying that because she was I think she was kind of Lebanese or something, and she was like a barrister, but I think she was the only barrister in Europe or something like that. And they were asking why aren't there more barristers that are not, you know, white. And she said, well, she did some research on it, and she found that it was not so much direct racism, it was more indirect, like, as you said, kind of like a bias, where she said people in power tend to want to give opportunity to people who look like them so they feel more comfortable, as opposed to they just hate other races or anything. So she's like, they felt more comfortable, this is in her research, they felt more comfortable kind of giving a leg up to people that kind of looked like them, as an example. And that's why she was saying, like, they tend to give opportunity, job opportunities and stuff like that, to people that kind of looked more like them, where it was the same hairstyle or anything, the same dress sense, and it was more yes. like an unconscious bias as opposed to anything else.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. What about you, Emil?
Yeah, definitely. When we go back to who were your idols? Your idols are people that generally you can relate to and look like you.
Yes.
You know, we talk about managers being in football. The people who are hiring the managers don't generally look like the black managers being in football, and the people who are hiring are generally white people. So it's just a human habit, isn't it? Because as well, yes. I'm guessing if you was in a group, a room, a hall full of people sitting down eating food, and you see one black person, you're going to go and sit with that one black person.
yeah. That I was just about to say the same thing. You know, it is about habit, and it is about, you know, when black people of a certain age get together, we speak in if you're from the West Indies, the West Indies, and we get together, there's going to be a little West Indian twang that will come out, and then we will be speaking in native language. The same with people from different countries. So if it's you know, there's no potential, you know, bias. It is just people who are comfortable.
Familiarity,
And what I'm saying is that's not always about color. That's, for me, it's always number one before color comes class. Because if you're a black person who's gone to Eton, you're going to speak a certain way, you're going to have networked with certain people, and you're going to have learned different things. And you will still have that group, and you will still network with that group, and they'll probably be, that person will be quite successful. I just think it's about who, the kind of environment that you've grown up with. Now, there may be some other issues of real kind of overt racism where people still see people in a certain way. But I think in the kind of industry that we're in now, just to kind of touch on our career, it is a shame today when you think about all the agents in England, you can't really name any top black agents that, you know, who were, here's the caveat, who work for themselves.
No, there's none. Well, right. I couldn't name you any.
Right, there you go. Who worked for themselves. Possibly at one stage, Sky Andrew was probably, he worked for himself. He had his own company.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know what he's doing. He was obviously an inspiration for us all in the past. You know, he was one of the first big names. But Charles Collymore, who I used to work for as well. But apart from that, the younger generation, you know, there's none. You don't hear of it. You don't you can't name them. You know, Emil couldn't name one. If you can't name them. And that goes on to, like I said, for the future, we'll talk about this in the future. But if you look at the system.
Part five,
maybe. Yeah, the system the system is designed so that you will never be able to achieve that unless you go on yourself. And I think just to kind of move over to boxing as well, I remember Chris Eubank, senior, he was promoting a fight for his son on the ITV platform.
Yeah, yeah.
And I remember he sat there and he said, someone asked him a question and said, oh, you know, this pay-per-view didn't go very well or something like that. And they were alluding that it didn't go very well and how much did you make? And he paused and answered the question and said, it doesn't matter how much we made. What's important is that it's ours. So what he's done is said, yeah, I'm not going to go and work for these guys who are controlling everything. I'm going to go and do it myself. And I admire that because he's not then complaining about having to do this or work for this white person or whatever. He's saying, no, actually, I'm going to go and do it myself and create my own platform. So that really has to be admired in my opinion. And I think it's the way forward. Like, if you don't like something in this day and age, you can go and try and do it yourself.
Yeah.
And seek funding to do that. So I think that's a positive thing. But just going back to kind of highs and lows. So obviously, you know, starting off in early 2000s, it was quite difficult. Didn't really know what I was doing regarding contracts and stuff. And I called up one of my old friends, actually, who I went to school with. He was in my class. There's a guy called Trevor Chalice. I think he's at Bristol City now. He's like an academy coach. He was in England under 21. He played a couple games for QPR. And, you know, he was a friend. So I asked him, like, you know, how does a contract work and stuff, and kind of negotiated a player's contract from there and kind of moved forward. And then the French thing came into play. And, you know, I organised a lot of young players coming over from France, and I got clubs to come and watch them. And we kind of, in the end, just, you know, I started going into the French market, and you know, that was good, and made some deals and moved some players, and the network grew and kind of went from there. So yeah, that was a kind of upward curve. And then Panorama happened in 2006, but you know, we'll probably have to move on to another podcast, part three, to start
I tell you, Mark, you're just taking this over.
Yeah, sorry, but yeah,
okay,
let's go. We'll go.
No. Actually, yes. I do actually want you to talk about the Panorama thing before we finish off. We'll actually kind of use that. We've got about another 10 minutes or so. So if you'd like to, because I've known you for a couple of years and I don't know anything about this Panorama thing. So yeah, share that story.
Emil, do you know anything of this?
No, he's just popped out for a second. So
okay, no problem. So yeah, so the Panorama thing. Basically, I mean, it's well documented. It's out there on the internet. It was just a load of nonsense, really. I was accused of offering a bung, which is a backhander, to Mike Newell, the Luton manager, which never ever happened. And then that was it. And then I was put on a BBC program with lots of other people. And that was it. And that kind of, obviously quite disappointed, because the guy who had set me up for the filming was my old manager at Wembley. Mm-mm. It was a German guy. And, you know, he had kind of set me up and said, and led me along, saying like, oh, you know, can you introduce me to this guy? And, you know, it was really disappointing when there was no evidence and it was just, you know, low hanging fruit. Yes, trying to manipulate people who didn't know what they were doing or saying. But it was sensationalism and nothing came of it. But I think that was a low point, and that kind of affected the kind of operations of the business for a few years, which was annoying, really. But yeah, it obviously made me a bit stronger in the realization that actually, you know, you can't trust everybody, which I was probably quite a trusting person before.
And that's kind of what I wanted to just actually say, but you've kind of just mentioned it anyway, was because a part of this podcast is also to talk about the life lessons that we learn from every obstacle. Because I always say to people that don't see life as obstacles, just see it as a challenge to grow from. Because as I've always been taught, every challenge is an opportunity to grow. Every single challenge is an opportunity to grow. So as I say, you should, every failure teaches you a lesson, and the whole point of failing is to learn. And as that other saying goes, you either win or you learn. So you know, a lot of people think that successful people, and this is the thing that a lot of successful people say, that is often ignored by those who wish to be like them. This is the thing they say. They say that you didn't see all of my failures. You only know who I am based on my successes. And you didn't see the work that I had to go through, all the companies that got collapsed before I became successful. And, you know, it's shown in a lot of the information on a lot of these self-made millionaires and billionaires, that they had to have multiple failures to gain enough experience to learn why it didn't work, to then create a new path to create a success. But you only know in the public that that person exists because of their success, but you didn't see the groundwork and all the failures that led to that initial successful path. So every sort of failure has to happen in order for you to master it, to then become successful by making an alternative choice based on a failure in the first place. Every single person has to, like Sugar Ray Leonard, the famous boxer that we all know of. He, before he had his comeback fight against Marvin Hagler, he had been retired for 3.5 years due to a retinal issue with his eye. And at that time, I think he was a three-weight world champion multiple times in three different weight classes, one of the greatest ever. Took 3.5 years off. I know you guys know this story already. I'm just sharing it for the public. Took 3.5 years off, came back, and he said that in the first, I think his training camp was 6 months, which is really unusual because it's normally about 2 months. His training camp was 6 months, and he said for the first 3-4 months of his training camp, he was getting beaten up by everyone. People that were nowhere near his level were beating the crap out of him. Until he got good enough again through pain and through, you know, molding that technique again, that he became good enough through losing those sparring matches to then become sharp enough to win those sparring matches. So in that's a little encapsulation of life and how we're supposed to go through highs, but we have to go through lows to get to those highs. So that's kind of like what you've kind of summarized with panorama thing. So with all that, I kind of wanted to just ask you, based on the panorama thing, what life lessons did you get from that?
So I learned, first of all, that, it was quite funny because obviously it's not funny, but it affected me, but it affected the guy I was working with, Charles, as well, probably even more so, because it was his company I was working with. But it actually gave me more resolve not to change. Because everybody was saying, like, oh, you can't be too trusting. And most people went the other way and said, like, oh, I'm not going to trust anyone now. But I just stuck to my principles that, no, you know what? I'm not going to change being who I am or trusting a trusting person because of one person. And, the fact that they've tried to entrap me into saying something that wasn't true. And the manager who said something that wasn't true as well, maybe it was his interpretation of what was offered or what wasn't. But the point I'm making is that it actually reinforced that I was going to stick to my kind of principles and not become a kind of scorned, bitter person who doesn't trust anybody because of one really bad experience.
Yeah.
So what else it did teach me was that it taught me that, for saying that about not trusting people, it taught me to be a bit more kind of savvy in the public. But I mean, it was a bit strange because this guy was kind of someone who I'd taken, you know, my wife out. We'd gone out to eat with his girlfriend and stuff like that. So it was kind of just, like I said, from that point of view, I didn't change my perspective. It was just kind of like, all right, you know, what? This is a situation. This is where I'm at. I could choose to be bitter, or I could say not everybody's like that, and he's the one bad egg, which is what I chose to do. From a business perspective, it made me realize that clubs were not really that friendly towards agents. And that's where I realized it was a very anti-agent situation at the time in that kind of mid-2000s. And yeah, so that I learned that from that experience, really. I mean, you know, I've learned much more from other experiences. So, for example, one of them was contracts. You know, I've had deals where I've got right to the deal being done, and then people didn't have the integrity to follow up and pay or give me the contract at the last minute. So, I'm sure loads of agents have learned that lesson, and that's one thing I would give advice to any agent now, is say, get your contract sorted in advance, because if you don't, then, you know, people can sometimes, for whatever reason, they might get usurped from someone above them, underneath them or above them, to come and say, okay, well, we can't honor that. And then all of a sudden you're out of a deal. So I've learned from that in the past, lost money because of that, because of people's lack of integrity, and it's been tough. But those lessons have been good because I've learned from them. And like you said, I now work with contracts.
Yeah.
And if it's not on contract, then it's not real.
And can you share, because I want to finish on a high, just before we finish, because we're wrapping up now, can you just share a real highlight of your career as an agent, a short story and something like that?
I think the highest compliment that I've had as an agent is that 2 years ago, I think it was, possibly
you met me. Okay, cool.
I met you. No, I had a player from his first. A player called Enoch Shawomny, who had him at Luton. Then I stayed with him to the end of his career. And the highest compliment that I could have, and probably one of the proudest moments in my life, was that I was the best man at his wedding.
Oh, wow.
And that meant a lot to me, because it made me realise, for all the players that I've lost, or people who have parted company from working with me for whatever reason, this guy, like Emil said, you by default, when you're working in the industry you're working in, you have to become friendly or a friend of the player. And the longer time you work, you know, there's different type of relationships, but essentially you're working closely together. And for him to choose me as his best man for his wedding was probably the highest moment. Mm. I mean, you know, beyond making decent deals, decent commissions, moving people from different countries to different countries, doing Premier League deals. I mean, that's great. That's just work. That's day to day.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's no value that can be put on. For me personally, that player who was my first client, to say to a couple of years ago, will you be my best man? That was that's my highest honor so far.
Cool. I think that's a good place to stop. Any final words from you, Emil, before we wrap up?
No, that's fine. It's just great talking to you, Mark, and we'll get episode 3.
yeah, we're gonna be like James Bond with you.
I'm looking forward to it. I mean, listen, it's always great speaking, and I'm enjoying
sharing
the conversations, and I think they're important as well.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, definitely.
Thanks, guys. Okay, well, until part 3, and everybody listening, stay tuned, because we're going to have some more exciting guests coming on as well. In between our 25 episodes with Mark, we are going to get other guests in also. Peace and love, guys.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Hi, I'm Emil Heskey. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please share and like so we can share this message to the world.